Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Sarcoidosis is difficult to diagnose, easy to manage in most cases, tricky to treat in about 30% of the time, and is proving elusive when it comes to pinpointing a cause. Professor Paul Thomas is a consultant respiratory physician at the Prince of Wales Hospital in Sydney. He and his co-authors have written a narrative review of sarcoidosis, which is published at www.mja.com.au. Paul is my special guest on the pod today. What is sarcoidosis?
So sarcoidosis is technically a granulomatous disorder which affects particularly the lungs, the lymph nodes, the eyes, liver and spleen, also the joints and skin. By granulomatous, that means that the appearance under the microscope is that there are cells which react to a foreign protein and they cluster together in what is called a granuloma. That sort of appearance is seen in other diseases, including tuberculosis and some inflammatory bowel diseases. In the case of tuberculosis, we know what causes the disease. It's the mycobacterium or the bacterium that causes TB. But in inflammatory bowel disease and in sarcoidosis, it's an inflammatory reaction probably to something from the environment, but we don't know exactly what it is.
Is it an immune response?
It most likely is both an immune response that occurs only in some people, because there are genetic links. Now, those sort of genetic links have been sort of to some extent identified, but it does occur more commonly in families. But what suggests that there's also an environmental aspect to the disease is the fact that it does occur in, like for example, a husband and wife, presumably unrelated.
Yes.
So therefore, presumably it's an environmental challenge that they experience that then sets it off.
Given that there's a whole bunch of symptoms that can look similar across a variety of conditions, how does a GP or respiratory physician, how do you exclude other things and come up with a diagnosis of sarcoidosis?
It's actually very difficult, and a lot of patients present, and if you go back into their history, they say they've felt unwell for quite some years. Quite a few of them have probably had the disease for if not months, then sometimes years. And to make a diagnosis of sarcoidosis is very difficult because it's very it's subtle and varied in its presentation. The most acute sort of presentation is where people develop an arthritis and red spots on their, particularly on their legs, sometimes their forearm, which we call erythema nodosum. Those usually last for a few weeks. And if you do a chest x-ray at that time, sometimes you'll find that they've got lymph nodes in the middle of the chest. And that's sort of fairly classic of an acute presentation of sarcoidosis. Some of the other presentations that are not uncommon are having inflammation of the eye, a uveitis. Ophthalmologists, eye doctors, they are quite aware of the possibility of sarcoidosis and that they're sort of tuned in to looking for it. And sometimes it'll occur just as a uveitis on its own. Sometimes it'll actually be present in other parts of the body. And most ophthalmologists would actually look, if they think it's sarcoidosis, they'd usually ask for a chest x-ray. There is a blood test that's associated with sarcoidosis. It's called the angiotensin converting enzyme level. It's sensitive but not very specific. In other words, it is often increased in people with sarcoidosis, but the level being elevated doesn't necessarily mean it's due to sarcoidosis. It's relatively sensitive but not terribly specific.
Is it a case of excluding other conditions and deciding that what's left is sarcoidosis?
Yes, very much so. I think about 70% of cases of sarcoidosis have lung disease, and the worry is that if you see somebody with lymph nodes in the chest, it could be either tuberculosis or it could be a lymphoma. And so we need to get a biopsy which hopefully demonstrates neither of those is present. And when you've demonstrated that they're not present, then you're a lot happier that it is sarcoidosis.
What's the prevalence here in Australia?
It's about 4 to 6 per 100,000. Doesn't sound very much, but when you actually ask people, it's quite common for them to know somebody else who's got sarcoidosis. Being a chronic disease, it persists in a number of individuals, and so therefore, people with inactive sarcoidosis are sort of present in the community.
So, can this resolve on its own?
Yes, and the majority do. So, particularly the ones who present with the erythema nodosum and hilar lymph nodes, they have the best prognosis. It's called Löfgren's syndrome, and they sometimes present with uveitis too. And they often resolve spontaneously, and they have the best prognosis. And usually the signs of the disease have gone within about a year or so. If it's sort of more insidious onset, particularly if you have skin disease, then that's not a good sign. It's a sign that it's probably going to persist for longer.
And if it does persist untreated, what are the consequences?
In the majority, it doesn't interfere with their lives. Some get complications such as fibrosis in the lungs, and that fibrosis can gradually increase. And those are the ones we want to try and identify and try and prevent it from getting worse. And mm-hmm. We usually use drugs like corticosteroids to try and reduce that chance of it progressing. Other complications obviously affect the eye, and so they do need regular eye review. And rarely in Australia, but more commonly in America with African Americans, they get sort of chronic skin problems. And again, in the African American group, they more commonly get sarcoidosis affecting the heart, which is difficult to treat.
So what are the frontline treatments?
In the majority, we just observe, and we should observe them for probably at least 5 years before and see disease stability before we conclude that the disease has regressed. In those who we think there is disease progression, then we usually use prednisolone, the steroids, for at least a year, try and reduce the inflammation that's caused by the disease. If the disease is continuing to progress, or we're wanting to try and reduce the dose of steroids but not controlling the disease, we usually add another drug, an immunosuppressant like azathioprine or methotrexate. The rheumatologists tend to use methotrexate as a first-line drug before prednisolone, and it's fairly well tolerated, and they have greater experience in using methotrexate. Respiratory physicians are less keen on it simply because it is associated with lung fibrosis itself, so there's a sort of inherent bias in the prescribing habits. But a lot of rheumatologists also see patients with sarcoidosis. They mainly see them with joint symptoms, obviously.
Is there a lot of research that needs to be done in terms of sarcoidosis? Are there any surprises, do you think, that we haven't found yet about sarcoidosis?
Oh, I think so. I think that we really don't know the etiology of it. Whether it really is a single environmental agent that causes the disease, and it would fit with needing an environmental agent because the lung is affected most commonly, so it's probably an inspired antigen or mycobacterium that's doing it, or other bacterium, and so therefore it's probably requires both that challenge, and also it has to occur in somebody who has the susceptibility to forming these granulomas, and so we do need better epidemiological studies to try and identify those potential antigens more carefully, because we really don't know what we should be avoiding. There is the view that perhaps it isn't just one antigen, perhaps it's quite a number of environmental proteins that we're inhaling, and in a susceptible individual they produce this reaction, just one particular organism.
Has there been a rise in the prevalence?
Not to my knowledge. The data, there are data that are interesting in that if you have people who are associated with water contamination and mould, and environmental molds, they have a higher incidence of sarcoidosis. There was a larger than expected number of firemen with sarcoidosis diagnosed after the World Trade disaster. The thought was that it was something in the either in the building or in the use of the fire retardant. There have been case series where water damaged buildings have been associated with a 50-fold higher incidence of sarcoidosis than expected, that perhaps it's something to do with fungi, perhaps it's all molds, and perhaps that environment actually is conducive to actually getting the antigen, which then causes sarcoidosis. So there's a lot more to know about the etiology of the disease. It is very much complicated by the fact that you really need to do their HLA typing, so that's their sort of genetics, to see what subtype they have, because each subtype is associated with different types of sarcoid. So that makes it very complicated. It means you do need thousands of people to try and tease that detail out.
Is this something that GPs need to be on the lookout for and be skilled in diagnosing, or is this something they should pass on to a respiratory specialist?
I think that if you've got a patient who's either tired, got a cough, a chest X-ray would be very useful, particularly if it's a persistent dry cough. It's not very remarkable. And also patients who perhaps present with erythema nodosum, I think they should all have a chest X-ray, as well as having a history looking for other reasons why they might have erythema nodosum. And if you have somebody, again, who's got some of those symptoms, unexplained lymphadenopathy and unexplained uveitis, red eyes, I mean, those are the things that are markers. But as I said, it's actually a very difficult disease to diagnose. And I'm lucky because nearly all the patients are sent to me have had the diagnosis made already by somebody else. So I'm usually in a happy situation of being able to confirm it. I think probably the main thing is that when patients hear that they've got sarcoidosis, they reach for the keyboard and they tap the name in, and it comes up with the most severe and usually fatal cases. And so most of the patients are alarmed when they read about it. And a lot of it's from the American patient support groups.
Yes.
And although those groups do need to exist, it doesn't sort of explain that the vast majority of people do not fall into that category. They have a very good prognosis. As we said, 70% need no treatment, and it will go away on its own. And there's only a smaller proportion who actually have disease that needs long-term immunosuppression or other sort of major type sort of treatment,
okay,
like transplantation or biological agents. But the majority do extremely well. And I think it is a difficult disease to diagnose, and I think that doing a chest X-ray and an ACE level can be helpful in people. As I say, they're non-specific results, but if they are abnormal, then it does warrant looking for a biopsy to confirm the diagnosis.
Message number one sounds like, don't panic. Don't listen to Dr. Google.
Don't read Dr. Google.
Yes. Well, that applies to so many conditions.
It does, unfortunately.
Indeed. Okay, Paul, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.